just in kind of figuring out how to do it. I mean, Richard had started me lettering in Quark Express, which like most people don't even remember that program, but it was kind of like InDesign or like a page layout program, but you couldn't draw balloons. You couldn't do sound effects. It was basically just typing the words and formatting them kind of roughly in balloon shape. And then he would print them out and he would cut them out like with a X-Acto knife. We'd print them onto sticky back paper, cut them out with a X-Acto knife and stick them onto the artboards. And then he would draw the balloons around the words. And so I was saying, you know, this is like, we could totally make this easier if we worked in Adobe Illustrator. I could draw the balloons. So we started working in Illustrator, and I would draw the balloons, and we would cut those out with a X-Acto knife and stick them on the artboards. But you would have to, like, there would always be like a little white gap around the balloon where you couldn't cut them out quite exactly around the balloon. So there'd be like these little white gaps. So you'd have to go in with a pen and kind of touch up the artwork. And we, you know, within like a year, we had a small studio. We had like two or three other people working in the studio with us. And we kind of had it all like assembly line, like one person's drawing panel borders and one person's cutting them out and sticking them down. And I was doing kind of most of the lettering on the computer. And then I remember thinking like, okay, this is ridiculous, because at this point, like a lot of the comics were being computer colored. So these pages were being scanned into the computer with the lettering stuck on the artboards, and they were being scanned back into a computer, and somebody was coloring them in Photoshop. Or there was some other program that people were using at the time, but I don't, Ollie Optics used some other program. I don't remember what it was called, but it was basically, you know, people were kind of experimenting with coloring in Photoshop. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing things on the computer to print them out and then have them scan back in the computer? Why can't we just stick the lettering right on the artwork in the computer? And of course, like Marvel and DC are like, no, we've got our system set up. Don't disrupt it. And so the first book that we got to do that on was this issue of Wildcats for Jim Lee's studio, Wildstorm, which was part of Image at the time. And they called us up and they said, we've got this book. We need it turned around in 24 hours. We hear you guys are really fast with your computers. Can you do it? And we said, yeah. In fact, we can even shave a day off the process if you just let us send you the Illustrator files and then you guys merge them with the artwork on your end. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. So that was the first comic that we'd actually sort of, we called the electronic paste up, for lack of a better word, which was basically, you know, merging the Photoshop artwork with the Illustrator lettering on the computer. So the lettering never existed like physically until the actual comic came out.
Comic books and superheroes, with some nerdy peeps, writers, cartoonists, and so much more. So stick around and have some fun with the lovely and adorable Evil Web.
Hello, my sweet ones. I am the adorable Eva Webb, and this is Titular Characters. In this issue, we're featuring John Rochelle, a man instrumental in the development and process of modern comic book lettering. He's worked on comics for Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, Blizzard, and designed logos for the Avengers, Daredevil, Black Panther, and Angry Birds. He's created hundreds of font families, which have been used to letter millions of comic books, as well as appeared in video games, movies, TV shows, toy packages, t-shirts, and so much more. The list is really endless. He's the co-author of Comic Book Lettering, The Comic Craft Way, with Comic Craft co-founder Richard Starkings. And last year, he founded Swell Type, to manage the ever-expanding Comic Craft font library and release fun, friendly, functional fonts. It's super exciting that we get to talk to him tonight. How are you, John?
Glad to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. It is an absolute thrill to have you on my humble little show. You know, like I was saying earlier, it's not every day that I get to talk to somebody who has changed the face of comics, quite literally.
It's funny to look back and think that I might have had that kind of effect. Just kind of spent a lot of years just doing what I'm doing and hoping for the best, I suppose.
So for anybody who doesn't know, the Comic Craft fonts are pretty much the de facto standard comic book fonts. I mean, they've been pretty much everywhere. I have them. I haven't used them for the art on this podcast yet, but I do have like, gosh, oh boy, I'm not even going to remember their names right now, but they are just, they're beautiful, and they're perfect for what they are.
Oh, thanks.
What inspired you to start working with fonts and lettering to begin with?
Oh, I guess as far back as I can remember, I've always been designing things, whether it was like flyers for my bands in junior high and high school, things for school if they needed, you know, posters or banners or anything graphic designed. And this was before I even really knew what graphic design was. I just knew I really enjoyed like putting letters and making logos and doing that kind of work. And then just by chance, I discovered there was a graphic design major in college, and I did that at UCLA, and then just kind of fell into the comic book industry working for Richard Starkings.
Would you say you were a big comic book fan before you started working in comics?
Yeah, I kind of went through phases. I was a big Spider-Man fan from about age 8 to maybe like 12 or 13 when I discovered girls, and then it kind of fell by the wayside. Got back into it like a couple years later, like in the years when Todd McFarlane was drawing Spidey. I got really into it again just because I thought his art was so cool. And that kind of led into, that was like my college years, and that kind of led into when I started working in comics, was right around that time, just after college. But I basically only read Spider-Man comics. I never read any other, unless it was like a crossover with Spidey, because I mean, you know, there was like 4 or 5 Spidey titles a month, so that was like all I could afford.
When you started lettering, what did the world look like? This was before, you know, the digital fonts, am I correct?
Right. So Richard was one of the first people to buy a computer and sort of attempt to make a font out of his lettering. I think he'd seen a couple of people. I think John Byrne had made some fonts out of different people's lettering. And there was a guy, David Cody Weiss, had made a font. And Richard was he was lettering for Marvel in New York. And he sort of saw like, okay, this is happening, so I better, you know, get on top of it. And he bought himself a Mac and bought Fontographer and had a friend who was sort of computer savvy. And they sat together for some ridiculous amount of time, like a year, working on his font. And then I came around, he had the font and he had moved to Los Angeles, which is where I was. And he needed somebody who could type the scripts into the computer so that he could print out the balloons and stick them onto the artboards. And so that's what I started doing. I'd actually never trained to be a pen letterer. I was kind of the first, you know, I guess, of the digital generation. And my experience was working in Adobe Illustrator and Quark Express and Photoshop and all those programs. So I kind of brought a lot of computer experience to what he was doing. And he had all the comic book kind of pen lettering experience, and we kind of combined those skills. But his font, his first font, you know, he spent all this time building it. And I remember looking at it, you know, like the very first week or two that I was working for him and saying, this doesn't look anything like your pen lettering at all. Like he completely, you know, perfected it. He basically, you know, computers want to draw straight lines and round corners and perfect shapes. And he had sort of taken all of the imperfections out of his pen lettering. And so it just didn't even look like pen lettering. It just looked like kind of a really robotic version of comic book lettering. So, you know, it wasn't very long, maybe a month or two in, I was like, hey, can I do some tweaks to this? And he said, sure, go ahead. And we were lettering Marvels, which I kind of look back and I regret that Marvel, if you read Marvels, it's kind of this time lapse of our font development. I think the first two issues of that series were in his font. And then the third issue was my tweaks on his font. And then by the fourth issue, I had started from scratch and I just basically traced his pen lettering and created a new font from scratch. And that's in the fourth issue of Marvel. So if you go back and look at that book, it's like you can see the development of what we were doing with computer lettering. And I think the fourth one is the best looking one. But that was the first time I'd ever created a font on the computer. And I loved it. I thought it was so much fun creating this thing that was, it was kind of part art, but it was also like, it was also a tool. It was also this thing that you were using and he was using. And, you know, as other people started working for us, everybody was using this tool that I was building. And I just really loved that process.
Would you say that comic book lettering is a subset of calligraphy, or would you consider it a unique art form?
It's definitely a unique art form because, you know, the calligraphy is definitely a part of it, like the penmanship aspect of it. But I think what computer lettering has shown is that there's a lot more to it than that, because, you know, lots of people have access to our fonts, but you can still tell, like, when somebody is using them with skill and is has all the other skills that come along with it, which is like comes down to like placing the balloons on the page and creating sound effects and making everything sort of fit harmoniously with the artwork and the page as a whole and telling the story. So I think that's really the biggest skill is just being able to tell a story with those letters and those devices, you know, the balloons and the captions and all the different shapes and stuff.
So I was talking to this other letterer the other day, DC Hopkins. Mm-hmm. And he said something that I thought was really, really interesting. Really nice guy about that. And he said that lettering has changed the way that he reads comic books.
Yeah.
Can't look at a comic book the same way he did before. Is that a common thing with letterers? Do you experience that?
Yeah. I mean, lettering basically ruined comics for me. Like, I stopped being able to read them and enjoy them because I was always like, oh, that balloon should really be over there. And like, I was just kind of correcting them and I wasn't really getting lost in the stories anymore. So, you know, my comic readership actually tailed off pretty much around the time I started working on them. You know, aside from a few things here and there, you know, if somebody recommends something to me, but I really don't. I don't read too many comics anymore.
That's a shame.
I know. I mean, I guess the exception is if I'm working on something really good, like when I was lettering Astro City, that was always one where, you know, most of the time I would get about halfway through the issue and just kind of go, okay, and just put it down and just read the rest because I had to know what happened next. So that's an instance where it's like, if you're working on something really good, then it's a lot of fun because you're kind of experiencing the story as you're creating it. But then there's other ones where it's just like, just trying to get through it. And it's like, you're not even, I mean, you try to be sensitive to what's going on in each panel, but it's not like you're really getting lost in what's happening in the story.
Astro City is just an iconic book anyway. I imagine that like, if you were in any way involved with it, that you would just be captivated by it because it's Kurt Busiek at his best. And the artwork, I don't remember who the artist on that was, but it's just, it's mind-blowingly good.
Yeah, yeah. Brent Anderson did most of it, and then there was different artists here and there. But yeah, and that book was a lot of fun to work on too, just because Kurt's the kind of person that just values everybody in the process. Like a lot of the comics I lettered for Marvel or DC, you know, you're kind of just this. It's like, get the work done, turn it in. We don't want to hear your opinion about anything. You're just performing a task. But with Kurt, it's like, if I had a suggestion or I was like, hey, this doesn't make sense, or do you think this would be better like this? He's always ears. Like he just, everybody's in is as valid as anybody else's to him. And he just wants the comics to be great. And so it's, you know, being appreciated like that really always makes me want to put in my best effort and give it everything I have. And that just kind of, I think that's one of the reasons that series is so great through all these years with all these different people that have been involved, because everybody feels like they're really valued.
So earlier, you mentioned a photographer. That was a while ago. When Fontographer and Quark Express and those early Adobe products were big. Do you still use Fontographer to build fonts today, or have you moved on to better stuff?
Yeah, I was pretty much using Fontographer until about a year ago. It was like they haven't updated it in 10 years, and I was just clinging to it because I love it, because it's just this great, great tool. But really, I was feeling the limitations of it. So I managed to convert my workflow to Glyphs, which is also a really great program. It's just very, very different. So it took me a while to kind of get into the flow of it where I felt like I could really be productive. But it's a really cool program because the guys who build it it's just a small team of people, and you can post on their forums and they'll get back to you, and they'll like, oh, hey, I just posted an update. So they're constantly updating the program based on, you know, requests that the people make, that users make. So so I like being, you know, kind of part of that process. And it's got a lot of great features. But yeah, man, I clung to Fontographer for way past its expiration date.
Nice. I used Fontographer a couple of times in college.
Oh, yeah.
Just doing crazy stuff like ancient alphabets and just fun, interesting little projects like, oh, hey, this is possible. We should do this. And then we did it, and it was great.
It's just so easy to just get into it and start making stuff, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty hard, though. Fontographer is no joke because, you know, it's not like the kind of program where it's not like Photoshop, you know, where you've got layers and stuff like that, and you can do like really intricate advanced work. It's sort of like, I would say it's sort of like painting with a sledgehammer, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, a lot of the work of fonts too is like, there's kind of this initial burst of creativity and fun, and then there's a lot of hours of painstaking fine-tuning and kerning and spacing and, you know, all these characters that nobody's ever going to use. And the technical side of it can be really kind of mind-numbingly boring for a lot of people. I think that's kind of the... I mean, I feel glad because that keeps more people from competing with what I'm doing, is that I kind of enjoy that process, but I know a lot of people just are like, oh God, I can't stand another minute of this.
So when you work for Marvel or DC and you're working on one of their books, I imagine, is it like a motion picture where, you know, in the old days for motion pictures, they would design everything custom from scratch. Do Marvel and DC books require like new and original fonts, or do you use the same fonts that you use on everything else?
So, I mean, I haven't lettered a Marvel comic in probably 10 years. I think it's Eliopoulos' studio is still doing everything. But for the time that we were, you know, kind of the late 90s, early 2000s, when Comicraft was doing everything Marvel put out, we were creating a lot of new fonts because we really didn't want to keep using the same font on everything. And we really did want every book, or at least every line. Like we had an X-Men font, we had a Spider-Man font. You know, we had different things that we would use on different books. Both to like kind of set them up, give them a unique or like a cohesive look, but also to kind of try to match what the artists were doing and to make it look like, you know, my ideal is always like, if the lettering can look like the artist did it, then it's going to really feel like it's all part of the whole.
Are there things that like you would try like in the 1990s and early 2000s that you would do completely differently now, or has it been pretty static?
Yeah, I think most of the methods are still pretty much the same. Everybody's using Adobe Illustrator. And, you know, I see people doing stuff now that I never would have thought of. I mean, people have taken it kind of way past what we were doing. But I feel like it's kind of cool to look back now and realize like, oh, we were kind of establishing these processes just in kind of figuring out how to do it. I mean, Richard had started me lettering in Quark Express, which like most people don't even remember that program, but it was kind of like InDesign or like a page layout program, but you couldn't draw balloons. You couldn't do sound effects. It was basically just typing the words and formatting them kind of roughly in balloon shape. And then he would print them out and he would cut them out like with a X-Acto knife. We'd print them onto sticky back paper, cut them out with a X-Acto knife and stick them onto the artboards. And then he would draw the balloons around the words. And so I was saying, you know, this is like, we could totally make this easier if we worked in Adobe Illustrator. I could draw the balloons. So we started working in Illustrator, and I would draw the balloons, and we would cut those out with a X-Acto knife and stick them on the artboards. But you would have to, like, there would always be like a little white gap around the balloon where the, you know, you couldn't cut them out quite exactly around the balloon. So there'd be like these little white gaps. So you'd have to go in with a pen and kind of touch up the artwork. And we, you know, within like a year, we had a small studio. We had like two or three other people working in the studio with us. And we kind of had it all like assembly line, like one person's drawing panel borders and one person's cutting them out and sticking them down. And I was doing kind of most of the lettering on the computer. And then I remember thinking like, okay, this is ridiculous, because at this point, like a lot of the comics were being computer colored. So these pages were being scanned into the computer with the lettering stuck on the artboards, and they were being scanned back into a computer, and somebody was coloring them in Photoshop. Or there was some other program that people were using at the time, but I don't, Ollie Optics used some other program. I don't remember what it was called, but it was basically, you know, people were kind of experimenting with coloring in Photoshop. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing things on the computer to print them out and then have them scanned back in the computer? Why can't we just stick the lettering right on the artwork in the computer? And of course, like Marvel and DC are like, no, we've got our system set up. Don't disrupt it. And so the first book that we got to do that on was this issue of Wildcats for Jim Lee's studio, Wildstorm, which was part of Image at the time. And they called us up and they said, we've got this book. We need it turned around in 24 hours. We hear you guys are really fast with your computers. Can you do it? And we said, yeah. In fact, we can even shave a day off the process if you just let us send you the Illustrator files and then you guys merge them with the artwork on your end. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. So that was the first comic that we'd actually sort of, we called the electronic paste up, for lack of a better word, which was basically, you know, merging the Photoshop artwork with the Illustrator lettering on the computer. So the lettering never existed like physically until the actual comic came out. And that was just, you know, a matter of trying to beat a deadline and also having a studio like them that were way more open to trying new things. But then within like, you know, I think word got around, and within 6 months we were lettering X-Men comics that way. And Marvel's like, oh, you can shave a day off the production by emailing us files? Then yes, let's do it. And so all these things just kind of happened out of just like, you know, trying to beat a deadline and trying to figure out some way to make it go faster, but also, you know, trying to keep the quality up at the same time.
That's funny, though. Why didn't Marvel go along with that in the first place? Or was it just the way you pitched it to them?
It was, I mean, at first, Marvel wouldn't let Richard use the computer lettering on anything. They were really reluctant to do it because there was this kind of perception that computer lettering wasn't real lettering and that it was kind of fake. And it, you know, admittedly, it didn't look like pen lettering, so it was kind of obvious that it was different. So we only got to use it on these really low selling comics that you know weren't high profile ones. And so I lettered a lot of Hellstorm and Cage, and I can't even remember some of the books I lettered when I was starting out, which was good because it was like I was figuring out what I was doing, learning how to like letter comic books, which was the skill that I didn't have. So by the time we got onto X-Men and Spider-Man, like I was pretty good by that point. But they, you know, they just had their methods. You know, we FedEx the artwork to you, you letter it, you FedEx it back. And that's how they had everything set up. And like Marvel came around within like 6 months or a year, like mid-90s, they were like totally on board because this is great. This is saving us time. It looks great. You know, our fonts were looking good, and we were coloring the lettering, which was fun because I got to, you know, put gradients and drop shadows and that kind of stuff on the lettering. But DC, man, DC dug in their heels for like another 5 years. We were still having to send them physical printed out lettering till like into the 2000s because they just, I think it was just this level of control that you know, whoever was the editor in chief didn't want to give up that level of control.
That makes sense. What's your favorite book that you've ever lettered?
I have to say Astro City. That's always just a joy. And it was always, there was so much creative freedom to play around with different styles. Like I would do Art Deco and I would do Art Nouveau and I would throw in, and Kurt is like, has this huge graphic vocabulary. He's like a frustrated graphic designer. Like he was turning me on to people I'd never heard of, like Lion Decker and all these illustrators from like the 30s and 40s that he and Alex Ross were super into. And so we were always just throwing around like all these references, and I felt like I could just do whatever I wanted and it would be appreciated. And I also got to do the book collections, which was a lot of fun to design those. And I did the website. So it was kind of the whole thing. When there were toys and merchandise, I got to do the packaging on those.
Yeah, and I'd have to say Elephant Man is a close second, just because I had total control over like every page, every ad, all the credits pages and covers, and even the book collections. I just went crazy. Richard just let me kind of come up with anything I wanted to for the theme, and I was like photographing the books underwater and lighting them on fire, and I found a snow machine and we made snow and ashes for my fireplace, and even got up to my elbows in pig's blood for one of them. So that was just a chance to go crazy with the creativity.
Right now I'm actually working on a project that's been really fun, which is these Show Me History comics, which are historical biographies that are kind of aimed at, like, I'd say like 9-10 year olds, and they're biographies and they're true, but they're also really irreverent and funny and kind of sarcastic. And that's just another situation where the writers have really trusted me to do my thing and just have a lot of fun with the lettering and using different styles. Like Amelia Earhart is very 1920s Art Deco, and like Muhammad Ali with boxing posters, and Neil Armstrong with all the NASA stuff. So that's been a lot of fun.
Do you, when you work on a comic, is there a lot of thought that's put into like doing things like using kerning for emotional effects and just building resonance with letters?
Yeah, I think if you're doing a good job at lettering, you're always thinking about how it's going to sound in the reader's head. So how, like, what can I do visually to make this come alive? And if it's making the letters bounce up and down, if it's adding, you know, music notes or making things bigger or smaller, color. I mean, everything is really with that goal of making the story come alive so that they're not even conscious of what they're seeing. It sort of becomes like they're watching a movie in their head, and you're like the sound designer or something like that. So I think people have said lettering is the invisible art. You know, it's this thing that if you do it well, it's nobody notices, and people only notice the lettering if it's done badly, if it's distracting, or if it's somehow like you can't figure out what to read next. If you're making mistakes, then it's noticeable. But if you're doing it really well, it kind of disappears and just becomes sort of part of the whole.
Yeah, the first lettering I ever noticed was back in the 90s. I was reading Sandman.
Uh-huh.
And just the way the letters in that one worked were just so dynamic and unique and stylized. And that just sort of really woke me up and made me think about, oh, wow, this is an art form in and of itself.
Yeah. I mean, Todd Klein is just so good. Do you remember Sandman 50? It was all like these scrolls, and it was like the storybook kind of thing where everything was like, he really just merged all the lettering into the artwork. And I remember seeing that with Richard like really early on, and we were just like, oh my God, this is it. Like, this guy is just It was the best. We always would talk. We talked about Sandman 50 like for years after that.
I remember it. Sandman 50 was amazing. It was visually very striking.
And yeah, and it was an example of where like it was really he was really showing off like what he could do, but at the same time, it was all serving the story completely. So it was like he really struck that balance well.
Who, I mean, other than yourself, obviously, who would you say your favorite letterer is?
For me, I mean, Todd Klein's one of them that I became aware of kind of after I started doing the process. But for me growing up, it was Artie Simek and Sam Rosen on those Spider-Man comics. And I think for me, that was probably the first, I think I was aware that there was a letterer just from reading the credits, because like Stan would always be like, you know, jazzy Johnny Romita, and he would have something sarcastic to say about the letterer every time. And so you were always aware that there were like, oh, there were people making these. And I didn't really realize what effect the letterer had until you'd read an issue that wasn't lettered by Sam Rosen or Artie Simek. And then to me, it was like, this isn't a real issue of Spider-Man. Even if it's the same artist, it just didn't look right to me. And so then I think I was only aware, like whenever it changed from one of those guys, that somehow it wasn't as good in my eyes. So I think, like I look back and going back now, you know, or you know, when I started lettering and looking back at that stuff and realizing how good they were, and especially how fast they worked, because I know that they were, you know, they were probably lettering 10 pages a day with pens and ink, and you know, I don't even know if they had liquid paper in the 60s. It was like they were just cranking that stuff out, and it's just all so beautiful and creative and fun, and it seems effortless. So those are still my kind of standards that I aspire to, I suppose.
What drives you creatively?
I really, especially this past few years, realized I really just loved making fonts. That was what I got the most creative satisfaction out of. And like I said before, it's that kind of combination of art and science and building a tool and building something that like I'm putting my artistic energy into it, but I'm also trying to make something useful. And then I get to see what other people do with it artistically. And that's always exciting to see my fonts show up. Like it's such a thrill when I'm walking through the grocery store, I'm always going down the cereal aisle and I'm looking at every cereal box, hoping I get to see my font. If I'm watching TV and it comes on a commercial, or you know, even the toilet paper package was like, oh my God, my fonts are on a toilet paper package. That's just, it's exciting to see. And it's cool to see things that people do with them that maybe I would not have done at all, but it's actually really creative and cool and unexpected. So it's kind of putting something out there that I'm inviting other people to be creative with. And I just love the process. I enjoy the creative side of it. I enjoy the technical side of it. I feel like I have so many ideas left to make that I'm never going to get around to them all. So that was kind of my impetus just over a year ago was Richard Knightley agreeing to split Comicraft in half, where he kept he's still doing the lettering with his crew and the publishing of Elephant Man and Ask for Mercy and the other comics. And I'm doing all the font stuff. And I'm, you know, creating new fonts, and I'm updating the old ones. And then I also have my own company, Swelltype, where I'm creating kind of different fonts that are maybe outside of comics, that are way more, like a lot more weights and more features and things that I've kind of stretching myself technically with those. So I've got an outlet for stuff that maybe doesn't really fit in the comics world, with Comicraft fonts. But I still enjoy making those too. So I'm kind of got the best of both worlds right now. And I'm just having a lot of fun.
You know, one thing I noticed, there were actually two things that I noticed about, the Comicraft website. Now if you don't buy Comicraft fonts, one thing, you know, that just sort of sticks in your head is that, well, comic fonts are pretty standard. You know, there's probably only a couple of font families. You know, there's not much you're going to do with them, but you go to Comic Craft and, oh my God, the selection there is ridiculous. You've got, you know, 12 different categories. You've got font families in every one of them. You've got like a free font giveaway. I don't remember what the current free one is, but it's neat.
Yeah.
They're pretty affordable too.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I guess part of that was me. Well, both Richard and I both, you know, have a lot of, like, we love comic books, but we also love Art Deco and Art Nouveau and, you know, Victorian tin cans and, you know, just all kinds of influences that we kind of brought into comics, depending on the story. If we found a reason to use, like, a lot of early, if you look at the first maybe 15 issues of Generation X from the 90s with Chris Pacello, we were doing all these tin can label designs. And it was funny because one issue, Chris sort of left a big space for the title. And we were like, oh my God, this is awesome. We can like put a title on the whole page. We can do all this big typography stuff. And when he found out, he was like, oh, this is great. I only have to draw like one little headshot and I get paid for the whole page. So he would do one little drawing and then he would leave the rest of the page for us to just go wild on. And we just had, you know, so much fun. I did a London Underground title. I remember, I did a big circus poster title spread where Stan Lee was kind of the ringmaster of the whole story. So, you know, we've always kind of brought like all these other influences into comics that aren't necessarily like, you know, Marvel Comics or DC or whatever. So that kind of provides a lot of the inspiration for the fonts. And I've always felt like I could, you know, I could kind of do anything and call it a Comic Craft font just because we made it. And there's probably a use for it in some kind of comic, whether it's a horror comic or a, you know, fantasy comic or, you know, sci-fi comic or whatever. You're going to need different fonts for different genres.
That's pretty awesome. It just is. I love the creativity of it. The other thing I noticed was all of the amazing sci-fi and comics references in the font names and on the website. Yeah. They are great. They are truly entertaining.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you appreciate that. Richard and I will spend sometimes... we'll spend almost longer deciding what to name a font than it did to take me to make it because we just go back and forth. Like the name's got to be perfect and it can, sometimes it takes a long time to find one. And then you also got to find one that nobody else has used before. But when you land on the right name, then it's like, okay, that's it. Now it's finished.
Nice. I think you guys had one called like Resistance is Futile or something along those lines. It was great. That was my favorite font name like of all time.
There's the Doctor Who reference right there, right?
Totally. Or it might have been Star Trek. Either way.
I think we had, because we had Resistance is Futile and Resistance is Useless. And I can't remember which one is which.
And there's another one called Exterminate, I think.
Yep, that's the Daleks, right?
Yeah, totally. And that just brought to mind like Daleks and... on the website, you've got like a picture of this generic robot saying it, because obviously you can't use Daleks. Yeah. But that just sort of like hammered it home for me. That just made me say, oh, wow, that is neat. And if I ever need a font like that, I'm using that one.
Cool.
So now is the part of the show where I get to have a little fun and ask you about your internal superhero. Who is that person? What do they look like? What are their powers?
Like if I was a superhero or somebody that inspires me?
Either way, usually the scenario goes like this. You wake up one morning, you are imbued with superpowers and a super identity of some kind. What does that person look like? What do they do? How are those powers used?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I mean, as far as powers go, if I've always wanted to fly, that would be my choice of powers. What I would do with it though, I don't know.
One common answer I get on what would you do with it is, people are always telling me, oh, well, I guess I would just do superhero Uber or something like that. Oh, it's great. Do you see yourself as a hero or an anti-hero?
Oh, probably a hero. I'm always trying to help people. I'm always fixing things around the house. Maybe if I could split myself in half, like create like a clone or something that could go and fix everything that's going wrong in my house all day long so that I could just do what I want, that would be nice.
That would be fantastic. And then you could like merge with it later. So, you know, you get the experience of doing it all.
Exactly. I could just send my clone off to like unclog the sink and replace the light bulbs and, you know.
That would be fun. Because that way you get to just do all the fun stuff without any of the adulting, yeah. And you're totally set.
Exactly. Okay, I think we've got it. I don't know if that's a very exciting comic to read, but I would enjoy it.
I like it.
It actually reminds me of a what if there was a what if Peter Parker's clone had lived. And I think the end of the story was they basically decided to like split up the week. Like I'll do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you can be Spider-Man Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and we'll flip for Sundays. And that was like the punchline of the story. It'd be something like that.
That's perfect. Now, that's how I would handle it. If I had a clone that was like just sort of a permanent clone, we would definitely be... Well, no. If I had a permanent clone, we'd be doing twice the billable hours. That's what we would do.
That's a good idea.
That way you hire somebody else to do the adulting and you bring in the money, you're all set.
Yeah, exactly. My wife and I always say we need a wife or we need a husband so that we don't have to do that stuff.
Right on. Okay, so you had this amazing question for my little my happy little audience, and they responded really, really well to it.
Yeah, that was so cool to see.
It's so neat. I mention this in every podcast because it's the God's honest truth. My friends on Twitter are some of the best. Not just comic fans, but just in general as people. They are some of the best people in the whole world. They are just amazing, and I love them. Okay, so bear with me for just 1 minute. Got it. So your speculative question was, when was the first time you remember being aware of lettering in a comic? And what I added was, what part of the lettering did you notice first? The voice bubbles, logos, effect, and somebody chimed in and corrected me and pointed out that they are not called voice bubbles. They are called word balloons. And I will take my humble pie on that one. I did not know. And the person to thank there is Bob Harrison, who is very, very nice in doing that. Would you like to take hear some of the answers?
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. So Doug Kane said, aware of lettering. He says, Tom I can't pronounce that.
Orzakowski.
Orzakowski, yeah. In Uncanny X-Men was the first letterer I know by name. Saw it in an art form, Bob Lapman in Justice League and Justice League International.
I'm not familiar with the Justice... I know Bob Lapman, but I'm not familiar with the Justice League, but... Tom Orzechowski in X-Men was one of the people that Richard turned me on to when I first started working for him. And it was basically like, look at this guy. He's the best. It was, and just the sheer amount of words that he had to fit into the tiniest spaces. And he managed to do it and make it readable and make it stylish. And with a pen is still astounding when I look at his work. I don't know how he did it. He was just truly the master of that. You know, I don't think anybody else could have lettered those Chris Claremont comics and had them be as successful as they were.
Oh, definitely. Those comics are just legendary all the way around. And Dr. Butcher, MD, said he likes Arkham Asylum, Sirius House on Sirius Earth. The art, the content, the chaotic mix, of lettering styles, etc. He says, I read it, or he says, I read it as a young child, probably a year after it came out, and had no idea that you could do any of those things in a comic book.
He's reading Arkham Asylum as a young child? That's... Yikes. I'm glad he's okay. Yeah, I remember seeing that because that was pre-computer. That was... it was Todd Klein's lettering, if I'm not wrong. And it was... And they somehow did all those effects, like, photomechanically, which is great because, I mean, there was, like, color... You know, color knockouts with drop shadows, and he would do the reversed out lettering. And somebody, whoever did the production on that book, must have just been pulling their hair out. But they're amazing. That was definitely inspiring, you know, using the computer and being like, oh, yeah, we could do that, you know, really easily on the computer. But it was, yeah, definitely an influence for just what was possible and even taking it further.
That's really cool. The panel that he posted was really cool too. It's with the Joker and
kind of splattery blood splatter lettering.
Yeah, it's really disconcerting. But I remember when I was a kid and I read that one. The artwork in general, just that whole comic was just sort of designed to shake you, and just the artistic style, the story, just every bit of it. It's a hard one to forget.
Yeah.
So Mike Fox said, Cerberus, there was this one scene where it was affected to show someone rambling, and I realized I wasn't compelled to read every word, even though they were written. I get that it's also art, not just a mechanical process. I was fairly young.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Dave Sims lettering is kind of it's one of the quintessential examples of the lettering and the art just being one thing. And he was his balloons were so expressive. I remember looking at a lot of that and trying to capture that on the computer and trying to get that kind of looseness that he had and just expressiveness. And sometimes, you know, even working on the computer, I would sit there with just a sketch pad and sketch it out with a pencil to see how it would look if I drew it with, you know, with a pen or pencil, and then try to recreate that on the computer just to kind of get that like hand-drawn liveliness to it. But yeah, his work's fantastic. And I was always jealous because every single year he would win the Eisner for best lettering. And I'd be like, Dave, like, come on, man. Give the rest of us a chance here.
I feel you there.
And we've never won the Eisner for best lettering. And now people win the Eisner using our fonts. And I feel like, well, I guess it's kind of like an honorary Eisner if people are using my fonts to letter the comic.
That totally counts. I would say that counts. You know, that is a piece of you that is winning an award. Totally valid.
We lost the battle, but we won the war.
Exactly. I'm just going to read one more because I found it entertaining. And that's from my old pal, Hell Yeah, Teen Superheroes. And they said there was a Looney Tunes comic where Daffy Duck explains how comics are made. I read it when I was 7 or something like that.
Now, I would love to see this. That sounds so cool.
You know, when they said that, I had this vague memory in my mind of reading that exact book. And I know exactly what book that is, but I can't, like, reach into my memory and pull out anything specific about it. And that's going to bug me for a bit. Yeah.
It'll just be one of those things you run across, like, 10 years from now, just by accident or something.
Oh, totally. And then I'll send you a tweet on Twitter saying, hey, I found it randomly. You know, you won't remember what I was talking about.
No, that would be good. I have a folder of things where it's, like, letter examples of lettering that's about lettering. There was this great strip that Richard sent me early on. It was an artist called Cody Simmons from the UK. And it's this, I don't even know if I can explain it, but it's a strip about using birth control. And it's, and it basically, it's the same strip four times with a couple, you know, like having dinner and then they're making out and then they're, and then it kind of, you know, fades. It's afterwards. And then there's a little cherub trying to insert the balloon that says, should we use contraception or something like that? And they're, and the cherub is trying to put the balloon into a panel and it's like, no, no, not there. Okay, wait, no, not there. And then they get to the end and it's like, oh, now it's too late. It was just such a clever use of the comic book device as an object. And also it worked on so many levels. I thought it was so creative. So it's kind of that same kind of thing where you're breaking out of the story itself to talk about the mechanics of it in an entertaining way.
That's amazing.
So I always try to save examples of those things just because, like, if I'm teaching a class or something, you want to show, like, what is lettering? It's like, no, this is what it is.
So, John, I wanted to thank you for coming to visit me on my humble little podcast. I sincerely appreciate it. Having you was so much fun on this show, and thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so honored to spend the time.
Fantastic. Where can people find you online and get your amazing fonts?
So our fonts are at comicbookfonts.com. My swell type fonts are swelltype.com. We're on all the My Fonts and FontSpring and all those distributors as well. And I'm on Twitter at John Rochelle and Facebook and Instagram and all those places.
Titular Characters is a dark and ancient tome of death and woe. Just kidding. It's a podcast. It's produced and hosted by the adorable Eva Webb. That's me. Podcast art by Lexiva, who is lovely, talented, and perfect. By the way, she's got a really neat comic going, and she's promoting it actively right now. So if you've got a podcast, book her while you still can. Just friendly advice. I'm not telling you what to do or nothing. Anyway, she's got extra links in the description of the show this week. You got to check them out. You got to see her comic. It's amazing. And she's family. We love her. Anyway, theme song this week by Antonia Marquis. Closing theme by Mikey Flash at Skate Force Music. And that's it, babies. Join us next time for another exciting adventure in cyberspace. Love ya.